Programming on NPR is supported by Brett Smith, your neighborhood baker of handmade hearth-baked breads and muffins featuring cranberry orange in November. Good morning. Welcome to Mid-Morning. I'm Catherine Lanfer. A recent poll in the Wall Street Journal reported that what people fear most in the upcoming century isn't crime or terrorism, it's loss of privacy. Yet another survey tells us that two-thirds of Americans don't trust that their medical records will remain confidential. The Clinton administration recently announced new proposals for regulating computerized medical data, but the plan has attracted critics on both sides of the question. What costs would such privacy measures load onto healthcare providers and thus onto their patients? What about those other kind of costs, such as your health? What if your medical data could help in research that may save lives, even your own? We'll look at some of those questions today with Dr. Barbara Yawn, Director of Research at the Olmsted Medical Center, a private nonprofit medical group in Rochester. But first, we're going to listen to a report done by NPR reporter Brent Wolf for NPR's special series on privacy called The Surveillance Society.
People taking a CPR class at the American Red Cross in Rochester are no strangers to medicine or technology. Some work at the Mayo Clinic or IBM, but the idea that all their medical records are in computer files still makes them nervous.
It's a little scary thinking that your medical records are out there on the, you know, accessible by hackers or by whoever.
You know, who has access to that once it's on there? It may have been originally intended for, you know, doctors or for research, but again, you know, maybe the janitor that's coming in there or, you know, just anybody off the street that has access to that computer would also have access to your medical information, and I don't agree with that.
Doctors and hospitals are computerizing complete patient records because they can access and manage the information more efficiently. It can be especially helpful in an emergency if a doctor can pull up a patient's health history on the emergency room computer instead of waiting for a patient's file from the records department. The Minnesota Health Data Institute estimates about 15% of patient records are currently computerized nationwide, and technology experts expect a rapid increase in the coming years. But Twyla Brace, with a watchdog group called the Citizens Council on Healthcare, says the convenience comes at a cost.
There is a definite danger that the information can be shared, it can be transmitted, and it can be linked, all in ways that the patient isn't comfortable with. And in the end, the convenience won't be as important anymore as is the protection of confidentiality.
Most people concerned about the privacy of their medical records worry about insurance companies or their employer getting too much information. Life insurance companies decide who to underwrite and how much to charge them based on an assessment of their health. That assessment is checked against information from a health database called the Medical Information Bureau. Insurers set up the MIB at the turn of the century to fight fraud. Member companies send in medical information gathered from their questionnaires to see what pre-existing conditions applicants have reported to other members. George Battis, Chief Medical Director with Minnesota Life, says the company needs to verify the health of its applicants.
We have an obligation to our clients that already have insurance to price risks correctly and accordingly. And if we don't do a good job, we won't have money around for them. So we watch very carefully. Do we want to continue a contract where you can't get a hold of any medical information and they won't answer any questions? It puts us at a very hard chance as to how do we proceed or do we want to proceed.
There are also concerns that some companies may access health records to help make personnel decisions, something federal law clearly seeks to prohibit. Joe Thompson, staff vice president at 3M, says that would be unethical as well as illegal.
There isn't a lot to be gained by getting this information, as I see it from an employer's perspective. All you can get is controversy and questioned about something that you really can't use if you have it. I mean, it's hard to fathom how that data could help.
Thompson says the Americans with Disabilities Act prohibits an employer from using health data in hiring and firing decisions. Those who tout the benefits of electronic records say the computer data can be protected using technology. but right now health institutions are responsible for deciding how much security to provide. Earlier this year, technicians at the University of Michigan Health System accidentally put all patients' scheduling data on two unprotected web servers, which were accessed by online reporters tipped off to the web address. And some doctors, like Dr. Tim Schacker, who heads the University of Minnesota's HIV clinic, worry that too many people within a hospital can access a patient's records.
Any computer that I can sign on to, I can access their laboratory information, their X-ray information, their pathology, and that's not wrong, that's good. I mean, in order for me to provide effective care, I have to be able to do that. But the downside is that we don't have a good way yet to make sure that the people who shouldn't see that information don't.
Schacker says he's heard medical staff gossiping about HIV diagnoses in hospital elevators. He tries to head that off by sometimes using aliases on the chart on a patient's hospital door, but he can't change their name on the computer records. The Clinton administration recently issued regulations restricting the use and release of electronic medical records that may spur healthcare providers to install new protections for their data. One of those helping Minnesota healthcare providers tighten security is John Fraser, Director of Information Services with the Minnesota Health Data Institute. He says the institute is developing military-grade encryption software and electronic signatures and keys to protect health data.
What we want to do is provide so much security that it will be easier to break into the office and get the paper record than to attack the electronic side. And I think if we can raise the security level to that height, then we truly will have increased security over the paper record.
And Fraser says people have a misconception of how secure their paper records are.
It's simply a folder that gets put down on a counter or then put in the door of your waiting room, and it's all paper-based. There really is no security on that, except where there's some physical security, it might get locked up at night. But it gets transmitted through fax machines, it gets transmitted through mail, through couriers.
The beauty of the new technology is also its weakness. It's highly efficient. One computer disk can hold information on thousands of patients, and in the wrong hands cause significant damage. Those who worry about the misuse of medical documents hope the new federal regulations from the Department of Health and Human Services will deter most people from violating the privacy of computerized health data. But they still worry it will be too difficult to detect and prosecute those who do. I'm Brent Wolf, Minnesota Public Radio.
I'm Catherine Lanfer. You're listening to Mid-Morning here on Minnesota Public Radio. We're going to turn now to Dr. Barbara Yon. She's the Director of Research at the Olmsted Medical Center, a private not-for-profit medical group in Rochester. And prior to that research work, she was a family physician for 14 years. Dr. Yon, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
Now, if you could talk, you know, right before we heard Brent Wolf's piece, I mentioned this wonderful statistic that two-thirds of American adults say they don't trust their medical records are confidential. If you could talk to those two-thirds, what would you tell them?
I tell them that, indeed, they may have some reason to ask us to be concerned about it. I don't think that they should be quite as frightened as they are. And they need to divide it into sections. When we're talking about confidentiality, are they talking confidentiality within the insurance realm, within the physician's office, within life insurance, within this data bank that they heard about, or are they talking about research confidentiality? Most people do not understand that research is a very different enterprise than day-to-day patient care and insurance, and we have many different requirements than someone who's looking at medical records for any of those other reasons. So I'd ask them to learn a little bit more about research first before they throw us in with all of their other concerns.
All right. Well, why don't we take this opportunity to learn a little bit more about research? Describe what it is that you do at the Olmsted Medical Center. Obviously, the proximity to Mayo has people, I'm sure, their interest piqued?
I'm sure it does. At the Olmsted Medical Center and at the Mayo Clinic and other places that do medical records research, we have to go through several steps. We actually have to write a proposal that says, what exactly are we going to look at in the medical record? Why are we going to look at it? And what are we going to do with that information? How are we going to protect the security of that information? Exactly what people will have access to it? And then we have to take that to something called the Institutional Review Board. Our institutional review boards are approved federally. They have to have members of the community on them. They have to have ethicists on them. They have to have physicians and researchers on them. And their only job is to look at this research and say, are patients' rights protected? And when it's medical records research, the main thing they look at is the confidentiality of that information being adequately protected. So we have a step that most other people don't have to go through. I have to tell people what I'm going to do, how I'm going to lock that piece of information up, how I'm going to screen every employee that looks at that information. So I think we have recognized the very legitimate concern of patients, their need to keep their information to only people who can benefit, including themselves, from this information. And I think we're trying to meet those standards.
Now, when we say medical records research, can you give me an example? Is this literally just the paperwork from someone's chart?
That's correct. For example, if we wanted to look at the relationship, suppose it's 20 years ago, and we're going to try to decide if smoking has anything to do with lung cancer, we would look at medical records from people with lung cancer and try to decide what percentage of those people smoked according to their medical records. And then we'd look at another group of people who don't have lung cancer and decide how many of them smoke. We'd find out, as you know we already have, that many more people with lung cancer are smoking than people who don't have lung cancer. Therefore, there's an association. Those are the kinds of questions that we ask from medical records. We also ask about treatment and whether or not the treatments were effective, not always just in these controlled trials that people hear about, but the everyday treatments that have been around for a long time. How good is aspirin at helping us with prevention of heart disease? We can look in medical records to help us decide those things. The association with benzene in certain kinds of occupational hazards and cancer was discovered through medical records research. A lot of things that we now know, smoking in small birth weight babies, premature babies, calcium and osteoporosis, smoking and heart disease, all those associations were discovered using medical records research.
Now, most of us don't even know when our records have been used for research, correct?
You may not. That's correct. If you ask, you can be told. But you may not know, it's very true, that your medical records were part of a very large study within a practice or across practices. Usually, if we do a cross-practices study, then someone from our site will look at our medical records, take all the patients' names and identifiers off of them before we share the final results with another site.
Now, I know that with the Clinton regulations that have come out, there has been a lot of consternation among researchers that their work is going to be hindered. Can you talk for a minute about the proposal by the Clinton administration to grant more privacy, to somehow build in more privacy, and whether how that will have an impact, say, on the Olmsted Medical Center?
Well, the Clinton administration regulations require us to get permission before we look at a patient's medical record for research. In Minnesota, this won't be a lot of change. We already have to do that because we have a special Minnesota law. But the impact has been that it is expensive for us to ask each person. It takes time for us to clearly explain to those people. We want them to understand what they are giving us permission to do. But more of much greater concern is what about the people who do not agree? And we do have some data on that. We know that people who have bad outcomes are less likely to agree. People who have some riskier lifestyles, like smoking, are less likely to agree. And when you do that, you really skew the sample. If in one study we did, for example, looking at infant and fetal death, about 60% of the women who smoked were not interested in participating, yet their babies experienced a very high number of SIDS deaths, sudden infant death syndrome. If we were not able to include their data, we would not be able to tell that smoking increased that baby's risk for SIDS, something that I think they all want to know and would find very important. So by not allowing access to everyone's record, we can have a very select sample of who does agree, people with only the best outcomes, people who have less risky lifestyles, and we're not going to be able to give the public the information they really need for the protection of their own health. Sometimes it's the protection of the health of those people who didn't agree.
We are talking to Dr. Barbara Yon. She's Director of Research at the Olmsted Medical Center. We are talking about privacy, more specifically. We're talking about the confidentiality, the privacy of your medical records. A lot of consternation in the wake of a proposal from the Clinton administration on making medical records more private, making them more confidential. Of course, now there's a lot of talk about the costs of these proposals, how much it's going to cost in dollars and cents to require patient approval before records, before different medical records are used for research. But there's another kind of cost, and that is if people, as Dr. Yon was just explaining, turn away from this sort of approval, what will the cost be in research, in healthcare? We're curious to know how you would achieve this balance of healthcare versus confidentiality. It's 1-800-242-2828, 1-800-242-2828. If you're in the Twin Cities, it's 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000. Now, Dr. Yon, I confess I'm a little confused because we've had this sort of regulation in Minnesota already where you need patient approval to use their records for research, correct?
That's correct.
Okay, but then how can it be that you can sometimes access this information and the patient doesn't know?
When we get the authorization in Minnesota, it is a general authorization. It says that you have my permission to use my medical records in medical records research.
Mm.
It is not, at this moment, fortunately, for each specific study.
Now, for instance, like when someone goes into the hospital, they do this? I mean, or have I signed this the last time I went for a physical and I just didn't realize it?
Not everyone in Minnesota is collecting this general authorization. Only sites that do a lot of medical records research are doing it right now. So you may never have signed it. If you live in Rochester or ever been to the doctor or the hospital in Rochester, Minnesota, you have signed such a card. You've been, or at least you've been asked to sign it or to refuse to sign it. And yes, we have to ask when people come into the hospital for the first time or when they come into the medical office for the first time or when they come to the laboratory for testing for the first time. And then we can use their medical records until they change their mind. It's very time-consuming to do that, and if we had to do it for every single study, we estimate that it would increase the costs of many of those studies by 20 to 40%. And there are problems. For example, what happens with the people who died from their disease? How do we get permission from them to use their medical records? Do we track down the next of kin who may live in another country or clear across this country?
We're going to go to Connie. She's calling us from International Falls. Welcome to Mid-Morning, Connie.
Yes, good morning.
Hi.
I'm calling because I'm for more privacy. I have a condition, like a venereal disease condition, and when I need to see a doctor instead of going to the facility up here, I travel 200 miles to Virginia to go to make sure that my records are kept secure and safe and so that people in my town don't know my medical condition. And it's kind of a frightening thing because when I do have colds or need to have, you know, just a regular checkup, I have to travel all this extra way because I don't trust it. And I don't know that I'll ever change that. And if my records are more accessible by computers, I'm just wondering, you know, what will I do next?
Connie, I think that that's a concern that many people have. I'm sorry that you feel you have to go that far. Obviously, that's not convenient. I don't think electronic medical records are going to make it any more accessible to any more people than the paper medical records have. Because of the very tight controls that are being developed and the systems that we have in place to protect those records. I wonder what piece of your health care you're worried about. Are you worried that the receptionist is going to know and talk to somebody? Are you worried the physician? Are you worried the nurse is?
Those are the kinds of things, yes, that I do have problems with, because in our town is a smaller town, and, of course, most of us know each other. Everybody knows everybody. Everybody knows everybody's business. And I guess I am a little bit worried that some people, you know, would talk, that my information would not remain totally confidential. I think it would just be too juicy of a bit of information. You know, at the beginning of the show, there was this comment, well, you know, my cholesterol information isn't, you know, that I'm not that worried about my cholesterol information. Well, it's not the cholesterol information that people like me are worried about. It's more about maybe people in smaller towns who have special conditions that they don't care for everybody in the whole place to know about. And yes, I would be worried that the receptionist would know, that, you know, all these other people, and I know them, I work with them, I volunteer with them, I do a lot of things with these people, and you know, to keep this information away, I travel extreme distances to keep it that way.
And I think the idea that anyone's medical information is confidential from everyone who works in that medical office and has to help provide them care is not ever going to be possible, no matter how that data is collected. So that if indeed you're worried that the nurse who puts you in the room, or the physician who takes care of you, or the nurse or the receptionist that you make the appointment with is going to share that information, it's not going to make any difference whether it's electronic, paper, or if we never wrote it down anywhere. Your concerns are that it's 100% confidential. Nothing that you share with any other human being could ever be 100% confidential. However, all of us do believe that we have a responsibility to protect your rights for other people to not know your condition except as we take care of you. It sounds like what you're concerned about is confidentiality in the regular course of medical care, not confidentiality with research or other types of use of your medical record. And I don't know that any of us have a perfect answer for your concerns. I used to practice in a small town, too. We spent a lot of time talking to everyone about never sharing information, and we fired someone once when they talked about it in the hall, which was inappropriate. I think you have to know that we take it as seriously, we hope, as the patient. It doesn't feel the same for us as it does for you, but we do take that very seriously.
Is there actually a segment of training for a doctor where it is impressed upon the intern that this is serious, confidentiality has to be part of your practice?
Oh, it starts long before your internship. It starts the first day you walk into medical school, and you are taught to respect the rights of patients, both as the patient is there and the rights of all of their medical information. So this is something that we learn from day one, and the same in nursing school, the same in medical records technology school, like the people who type up the medical records or type dictations. All of those people are impressed upon them. People sign confidentiality agreements when they sign their employment agreements. Part of those confidentiality agreements say that if there is any concern that is proven about release of information or talking inappropriately, you'll lose your job, and people do.
We're talking to Dr. Barbara Yon. She is Director of Research at the Olmsted Medical Center, a private not-for-profit medical group in Rochester. Now, prior to that research post, she was a family physician for 14 years. We're talking about medical record confidentiality, the privacy of your medical records. Just how private should they be? Would you rather have privacy than, say, life-sustaining medical research? It's 1-800-242-2828, 1-800-242-2828. How would you try to balance those two needs? It's 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000. I'm Catherine Landfer. You're listening to Mid-Morning. We'll come right back to your calls after we take a break and listen to Perry Finelli. He's standing by with the latest from the Minnesota Public Radio Newsroom.
Thank you, Catherine. Egypt's top aviation official is on his way to the U.S. to join the Egypt Air crash probe. This comes as Cairo is questioning plans to turn over the case to the FBI. Egyptian officials want to hear tapes that suggest a co-pilot said a prayer before the plane went into a dive. Hurricane Lenny has become a Category 4 storm. Lenny's winds are near 135 miles per hour. As it bears down on Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands, tens of thousands of Puerto Ricans are already without power and water. Pope John Paul is planning to visit to the Holy Land next year. A Vatican spokesman says he'll visit in late March with stops in Jerusalem, Nazareth, and Bethlehem. Consumer and health groups want warnings on alcohol containers to be easier to read. They're asking the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms to toughen the labeling rules. Advocates say the current labels on bottles and cans are often tough to find, much less read. The state and the Minnesota Senior Federation plan to file a lawsuit against the federal government today over Medicare reimbursement. That's the first time a state has taken such action. The suit is based on inequities in federal payments to state Medicare HMOs, which are operated by the private sector but funded by the federal government. Minnesota lawmakers and government officials have challenged the disparity for years, but states that benefit from the current system have vigorously opposed any changes. And the man accused of killing convenience store clerk Katie Poyer wants to be transferred to the Twin Cities while he awaits trial on state murder charges. Donald Blum reportedly complains in letters to a judge that Carlton County is too far away for his family in Richfield to visit. Now the forecast for the region today, partly to mostly sunny skies, a little warmer than yesterday. We'll see high temperatures in the lower 40s in the Arrowhead and near 60 in southwestern sections of the state. For the Twin Cities today, mostly sunny with a high near 53. Right now in Sioux Falls, it's sunny and 39. In Duluth, it's sunny and 33. And in the Twin Cities, it's sunny and the temperature is 37 degrees. And Catherine, that's the latest from the Minnesota Public Radio Newsroom.
Thanks, Perry.
Are you in the market for a new car? Have the new 2000 models been tempting you? Or are you hoping to save some money on a 99? Hi, this is Bob Potter. We'll get some car shopping tips on Sound Money this week in the company of Paige Amadon from Consumer Reports. Chris Farrell and Erica Whitlinger, too, on Sound Money. Saturday morning at 10, again Sunday afternoon at 5 on Minnesota Public Radio, KNOW FM 91.1 in the Twin Cities.
I'm Catherine Lanfer. You're listening to Mid-Morning here on Minnesota Public Radio. We're continuing our conversation on just how private your medical record should be. We're talking with Dr. Barbara Yon, Director of Research at the Olmsted Medical Center. We're going to go to Marjorie in St. Paul. Welcome to Mid-Morning, Marjorie.
Good morning.
Hi.
My statement is, first of all, if it's just the data that you want about someone's condition and how it's affected them, I think the data should be separate from the person themselves. Do you understand what I'm saying? If you could somehow enter that data for your statistical research, that's one thing, but it shouldn't have a name connected to it. And second, I have Crohn's disease, and I have had problems with employers and insurance because of that. And it's not that you can't fight those issues, but when you do, it creates an image about you that's probably not positive. So those are my two issues.
All right. Thanks, Marjorie.
Thanks. That's a good question. When we do collect data for research, we do remove the names and other identifiers. Actually, we're very careful about removing the identifiers. We do need to know people's gender, and we obviously need to know your age because those make a lot of difference in diseases. We want to know probably what other kinds of conditions you have and what other things are recorded in the medical record, but we don't want to know your name. I don't want to know the names of all 2,000 people who are in some study. So we do remove your name and all identifiers. In fact, we're very careful about it to the point that if we're studying newborns, for example, we will not use the birth date and the site of the birth and the gender all linked together, because you could potentially identify that child if you went back and looked at birth records. So we are extremely careful to remove that information. However, to access that information, we do have to have access to specific charts. It is not possible to get that all on electronic databases at this point in time.
We're going to go to Brad in Minneapolis. Welcome to Mid-Morning.
Yes, thank you. There's an issue that I'm concerned about. As anyone that has a computer knows, the minute you see it on your screen, there's a common convenience to print it off. Anytime you go to an electronic patient record, you go from the possibility of having one physical record to thousands of physical records as people, for their convenience, just simply print off a screen. I know that's a real issue, and I'd also like to say, be very skeptical of your guest. She is clearly singing the song for research and medical establishment. What she just said is just not true. I worked on a research project where they were very, very lax about hiding names, and it was specifically set up by the IRB to be a blind study, but they were writing the names of the patients on the data sheets. It was very lax, and we need the prophylaxis of these legislative initiatives.
Dr. Yan?
Brad, I think you make a couple of good points, that you can set up systems, and if people do not follow through on the system, if no one is checking to see that anyone is following the rules the IRB set, then we have a problem.
I have to interject. What's the IRB?
The Institutional Review Board, the group that reviews the studies before they allow us access to any patient's records. Mm-hmm. So if indeed we do say we are going to do this, and then we don't do it, someone needs to be in there saying, you're not following the rules, your study is stopped. So I agree that there are things that can happen, and we do need to follow those rules, and we need to see that the rules are being followed in each study. So I think that's right. And Brad is absolutely right. I am singing the praises of medical record research, and I'm doing it because I think it is only through research that we're going to continue to advance healthcare and continue to be able to provide people with better and better solutions to their health problems. For example, a friend asked me the other day, what is the best treatment for breast cancer? Without having good medical research data on many, many patients, not just the ones with good outcomes, how can I possibly give her that kind of information? How can we give Brad the kind of information he needs when he goes to the office and says, I have a sore throat, what should I do about it? Or I have a much more serious condition, what should I do about that? So yes, I am singing the praises, but I hope what I'm doing is singing the praises for the benefits to all of society. It's a very difficult issue to weigh the rights of the individual against the rights of society and then the rights of that individual when they're ill.
You were mentioning earlier that at this point, because most medical records aren't computerized, you still need to go to specific charts where names are attached, et cetera. But there's many people actually fear loss of privacy more when all records are on computer files because they'll be so easily accessed by more people.
I think they do. And again, for research, if our IRBs are working the way they should, and if people are being whistleblowers, which they should be if the rules are not being followed, I would not have access to anyone's medical records electronically. I wouldn't have the passwords. I wouldn't know how to access those records until I've been through these approval processes. So there are steps. I cannot now go over and just type in any kind of a password and have total access to the medical records. We also have systems that allow us to look at who has logged in, what did they look at, why did they look at it, and if they don't have approval to do that because that's not a patient they saw, you can get back to them and say, why did you do that? As a researcher, if I'm looking at records I have not had approval to look at, they come back to me and say, why did you do that? You have to have justification, and had I done it, I could lose my job. So those systems are not 100% in place. I won't argue that, but we are working on it, and we think that we have most of them in place.
We're going to go to Joanne in Minneapolis. Welcome to Mid-Morning, Joanne.
Hi. I just wanted to talk a little bit about the health information professionals in the Minnesota area and in the national area. I am a credentialed health information professional and a program director of the health information programs at the College of St. Catherine. And I thought you might find it interesting that there is a national and state association of health information professionals that place a high priority on maintaining the privacy of individuals' health information, while allowing for the appropriate use for clinical information, for research and reimbursement. And we're constantly monitoring the legislation that is looking at the electronic health record and access to health information. I guess I wanted to ease the previous person's concern, I guess the person from the smaller community, mm-hmm. that each health information professional is instructed to maintain very high ethical standards. And as healthcare professionals in general, we consider ourselves gatekeepers for protecting your health information. And there's a high expectation to instruct others to keep that information confidential.
You know, Joanne, but here this woman is. She was calling us from a small town. Yes, your goals might be quite laudable, and I'm sure that most of the health information professionals are exemplary. But golly, what if it's in your village that you have the person who's a little more talkative? Then you're still out of luck.
You are out of luck, but as Barbara said, that there are very strict penalties within the healthcare organizations. People will lose their jobs if they are releasing information inappropriately. And so that is it's a very big concern for each individual person. But I think knowing that there are healthcare professionals that are there to really protect your records is an important concept for people to understand. That we're sincere about our efforts, and we also are sincere about teaching other people about maintaining healthcare confidentiality.
If you keep track of legislation, I'm curious what your take is then on the new Clinton proposals.
Well, our association feels that there should be a larger focus on the protection of all healthcare records. Right now, the Clinton proposal is addressing the electronic health record. And it is not looking at the paper records that will still be in facilities for many, many years. And so we would like to see legislation that protects all records, not just the electronic records.
Dr. Yan?
I think she's absolutely right. We would like to see legislation that balances the protection with the costs of that protection, but should be thought about for all medical records, since she's right, there are paper medical records and there will be for a very long time. So the concerns have been brought up because of the potential ease of transfer of electronic medical records. But as people have pointed out, you can fax paper around too. So we need to make sure all medical records are secure, and we think that we have done well. But there's nothing wrong with people saying, okay, let's make sure you're upholding the standards that you profess to.
We are talking to Dr. Barbara Yan, Director of Research at the Olmsted Medical Center, and we're asking her just how private should our medical records be. We're asking you, too. We'd like to have your insights, your observations on this conversation. It's 1-800-242-2828, 1-800-242-2828. If you're in the Twin Cities, it's 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000. Let's go to Steve in Minneapolis. Welcome to Mid-Morning, Steve. Hi, Steve.
Hi, I've been a physician in two large health plans, and I know that my codes can basically access about 300,000 medical records. And I entirely disagree with Dr. Yan that there are adequate protections for patients' medical data. Although abuses are rare, I think that there needs to be substantial additional work on need to know in terms of these records. The issue is not so much with research, but it's certainly with regard to clinical records. There is no privacy with an electronic medical record system, given the number of people who, once they have an access code to the general database system, which many people do, including all the doctors and many nurses, can simply wander through and pick any record they would want, and we just don't have adequate protections there.
I'm curious, Steve, do we have adequate protection with paper records?
Well, paper records are much more cumbersome to access because you have to go down to a file room and check them out. And so it's just more cumbersome to cruise through them. But, for example, if I wanted to identify the medical, find out about the medical records of a certain prominent person who happened to be in the health plan, I don't believe that I would have a great deal of difficulty doing so if that person was a member of a health plan that I worked for.
All right. Thanks, Steve. Dr. Yan?
But Steve, I think you said the really important thing. You're not talking about research, and that's the primary reason I'm here to talk today, is about research and the confidentiality for research. You may, in the plans you're working with, not feel that there's adequate protection for the practicing clinicians and the practicing nurses that deliver the regular patient care. But I would imagine all of the ones I've worked with in the Twin Cities, the large managed care, do indeed have this added security for research. We have for many, many, many years met a much higher standard of confidentiality and security than any practicing physician. I know, I've been on both sides of it. So when we talk about research, I think we have a very different issue. I'm not aware of a single lawsuit that has been brought from a research study that was medical records only that had to do with a breach of confidentiality. And I haven't been able to find anyone else that was either. The laws and the concerns people have brought up are from either practicing physicians and nurses and receptionists who have talked when they should not, or they have been from insurance companies, or they have been from pharmaceutical institutions, not necessarily large drug companies, but actually drugstore chains that have sold information. So I think when we come down to where does research fit into this, we are really talking about a different level of security that we have instituted and do maintain.
Yet it's curious. We keep getting call after call that I think fairly demonstrates people's apprehension. And even if their apprehension is, say, about a clinical record, couldn't that potentially have an impact on the sort of record research that you do?
Oh, absolutely, because if people are frightened and concerned about confidentiality, they're likely to say, no, we can't use their medical records in research, and they're going to therefore give us a very limited sample of people that are studied. A good example of this is clinical trials. People have to sign up and should have to sign up very carefully for a clinical trial for a new treatment. We know, for example, that 1% of women who have breast cancer in the United States actually ever sign up for a clinical trial. So then we do the study. We get information from this very small group of people. The drug may get out on the market, and then it's used in thousands or hundreds of thousands of people, and people are shocked when a drug has to be removed from the market because of side effects. Why wasn't it found in the first studies? Well, one of the reasons is because we have such a very small specialized sample. We don't want to have to do that in medical records research to get that kind of very restricted information and give people what could well be wrong answers.
We're going to go to Melissa in Rochester. Welcome to Mid-Morning.
Well, hi.
Hi.
Great show. I would like to just point out two things. Number one, I think that we need to be really, really conscious and careful when we're using medical records for research that that data is being kept confidential. And like the previous caller said, perhaps we need to have more whistleblowers in the group. I don't know if that gentleman decided to go forward and complain about what he was seeing done, but I don't know that that's done very frequently.
Melissa, what are your concerns, actually?
Well, I, for example, I have a daughter who's adopted.
Mm-hmm.
And she would be wonderful for research in the medical records. I'm sure that there are many things that her record could be used for. But I have said no on her admission form when she goes to the doctor because I am not confident that her information is truly going to be kept confidential. Now, the other point
is... Well, I'm going to stop you, Melissa, because I think it'd be helpful for someone to spell out, and what is it, I mean, does she have, and you don't have to tell us the exact condition, but does she have a specific condition that you think would hurt her later in life if people found out she had it?
No. No, she doesn't. I am just not confident that in a community the size of Rochester or any smaller community that information is truly going to be confidential and not disseminated in the community.
But the point of today's conversation is, what is the price of your privacy? What if keeping her out of this study, you know, the exponential effect, if so many people do that, then we don't have the kind of medical record research we need. I mean, do you fear things on the other side of this equation that maybe you're helping, you're not helping to achieve a cure for something?
Well, I do. I actually do have that fear and concern. And I would like to make another point that perhaps we need to put a little more money into the research and get individual consent for individual studies. If Dr. Yuan came to me and said, you know, we think that your daughter's medical record might be useful in this study, would you consent to that? I might be more willing to say, yes, okay, for this study, I'll agree to that. I know that that puts a horrendous burden on her staff to do that, but perhaps that money would be very well spent so that she could have a larger sample and get better results.
Dr. Yan?
It would perhaps be possible, but if you've ever tried to call 1,000 people, you know that it's very difficult. It takes on average 5 or 6 telephone calls. It takes 3 to 4 letters, and we still get only 80% response. So if we had that kind of a burden, we might get people like you to respond the first time, and that would be great. But we have a lot of other people that we would have a terrible time tracking down. And we're not talking about a small cost. We're talking about a large cost. And as you know, we have a fixed amount of dollars we can spend on research by the decision of the public and the federal government and a lot of people. So what you're talking about is adding cost to each of the studies, potentially, as I said, 20 to 40% increase in cost. That translates directly to a 20 to 40% decrease in the number of studies that I can do, with questionable benefit for you. What is the benefit for you, for me to tell you about this exact study? Your daughter's medical records are still subject to all of the other concerns that other people have talked about, and you have stopped it only in this one area, and that's research, where everyone except Brad agrees there are special considerations. And actually, it wasn't Brad that asked for whistleblowers. It was me that asked for whistleblowers, and I hope Brad did that. So is the cost worth it to decrease the number of medical research studies by 20 to 40%? The study that I might have to throw away and not be able to do may be the one that relates to your daughter's condition or your husband's or your son's or your neighbor's or your mother's. How do we balance that?
We're going to go to Mary in Minneapolis. Welcome to Mid-Morning.
Thank you.
Hi.
Hi. I just wanted to say that we, in fact, did not sign release papers for my parents' medical records to go to a research program because there has been evidence of Alzheimer's in 3 generations now of our family. And we sent my parents. We had an autopsy done, and they did die from Alzheimer's. And the reason we didn't sign this was because of the concept that at this time there are no safeguards for pre-existing conditions regarding coverage for insurance. And we felt that this information would not be good to have on medical records. And in fact, I've been advised by a physician not to divulge that information about history of Alzheimer's in our family. And so the research that suffers from not having that, and I think until pre-existing condition, that issue is taken care of, this will continue to exist. And so they have to work together, the research and the to get legislation to have pre-existing conditions covered for insurance.
Actually, there has been quite a bit of legislation to work on that issue. I'm not going to tell you it's solved, but there has. You're making an assumption that by releasing that information to researchers, someone is going to link that to you or to other members of your family. I don't know that that is at all possible unless that was the specific request in that study. If it was, then you may have reason to think twice about it, but I don't think you have reason to be concerned because that information would not then go back in your medical record if the research is on your parents. So I think that what you might be confusing and other people do too, is telling your physician that there is a history of Alzheimer's in your family, having it appear on your medical record versus having your parents who have the Alzheimer's having it on their medical record so we can try to study what went on with Alzheimer's with them. So I think there is a confusion back and forth.
Oh, but if all the medical records become computerized, you know, I think what some people fear is this notion that someone can click on and can look at an entire family of medical records.
I think people are concerned about that, and I think those are safeguards that are going to have to be taken to figure out how do we see that those don't get linked. And I think those are things we are working on. Again, that could happen in a research study, but how would that information then get linked back or leaked back to your insurance company, since most researchers do not keep their data in any place where an insurance company has access to it? We don't keep it on the same mainframe computer. We usually keep it in another computer somewhere else where you can't get access to it, or it's password protected in very special files. So it would be very unusual for us to have research data that links across multiple people's medical records that would then be accessible to an insurance company, to an employer, or to the other kinds of people that that Mary was stating her fears are about.
We're going to go to Mark in Richfield. Welcome to Mid-Morning.
Well, good morning.
Hi.
Well, one of my... I've been a many-year IT or information services person in the medical field, and one of my big concerns is I think the average patient would, you know, sure, this would be great to be part of a research study, but once your data is owned by that clinic, it's fed into most likely a, you know, multi-clinic hospital, maybe even HMO, you know, setting. So the research unit that may be research study that may be one of the receivers of this data might do due diligence, but the other units may not. And I've whistleblowed more times than I can even count. And it was a security departments and IAS tend to be quite understaffed, and the cost of encrypting or securing data is often viewed as something that can, well, we just can't afford that, or we'll do it later. And it's a huge problem. It's causing a lot of burnout in IS professionals because they're kept a little bit in the dark about.
Dr. Yan?
I think that your concern is not at the individual level, but you're worrying about as it gets farther and farther from the individual patient when data gets amassed in larger and larger groups. And I think that's exactly the kind of thing that these legislative requirements are intended for, is when you start amassing large amounts of patient data. But again, that data can go without identifiers, and there is no reason for most research studies to not have that data go without identifiers, so that the person in that larger center doesn't have to know that that's Mary Jones' record or that that's record number 2465. All they need to know is that's patient 16 in the study or patient 3000 in the study. Those things can be solved and need to be solved, and we need people like you that make sure they continue to be followed and that people don't get sloppy.
Dr. Yan, we are out of time. I want to thank